Hi, I'm Jeff Nyquist. I'm in America and I'm with Alex Benesch, who's in Germany. We're going to talk about the Stasi, which was the East German intelligence service. A lot of people talk about the CIA today and they want to say how bad the CIA is or the FBI. And we just had a chat about the FBI and CIA last week, Michael Waller's book. But the Stasi is a different kettle of fish. And for those who think that the CIA is all powerful and can do all these things. I mean, the Stasi really did do all kinds of things. The Stasi was excellent, even though the Germans in World War II didn't have the best intelligence service. Once the communists took them over and the Russian KGB taught them their tricks, they were really top-notch. And people like Marcus Wolf, who was in charge of the Stasi spying in West Germany, they did some incredible things. And they ran circles not just around the West German services and West Germany in general, but they ran circles around the United States and the CIA. So, Alex, maybe you want to begin. There's two books. One was The Gray Men by Ralph Hope, which is a pretty good primer on how the Stasi still is active in Germany. They're well financed, according to him. They're politically involved, and of course, I had a reader who was recently in Berlin saying one of these a well-informed gangster type told him, well, Berlin is full of Stasi right now. It's what do you mean KGB? It's full of Stasi. And of course, this is the thing that we have with John Koller's book, which is an older book, Stasi, The Untold Story of the East German Secret Police. And in this book, it goes into all of the successes and the repression, which I think you're going to go into. For example, Marcus Wolf's Romeos, seducing lonely secretaries in government ministries, spies in the diplomatic service. I mean, they caught a dozen of them. The German police were riddled with Stasi agents, according to Koller. And German counterintelligence was penetrated again and again. So, and that's not to mention the German journalists, dozens of German journalists were exposed as Stasi agents during the Cold War, including the Berlin bureau chief of Der Spiegel, who had spied for the communists for 30 years before he was caught. Just one example. So, I mean, imagine how free the German press was if so many of their press people were agents of the Stasi.
Yeah, I think it's a common misconception among people today that the Stasi would come after you domestically when you were involved in really subversive activity or you wanted to escape the Communist Republic and that sort of thing. But no, they would come after you for anything. Environmental activism, they would come after you for women's rights activism. They would come after you for calling for a nicer form of socialism. See, this is something that I think the woke generation nowadays doesn't understand. So woke people, or generally the left nowadays, they think that anti-communists were paranoid, but look at the Stasi and the level of infiltration of society. So you're in a society where literally anybody could be spying on you, and they will spy on you for any cause. So right now, for the Western left, it's all about critical theory. It's about complaining this, complaining about that. Just complain, complain, complain your way to the top. But once you are under communist control, there's no more complaining. So all this critical theory stuff, goes out the window, and you become a target. Not only is it regarded as criminal, it's also sometimes regarded as mentally ill. So the Stasi, KGB, and other services, they would put you into a mental institution, and the Stasi also had a larger plan for internment camps. So to use on a regular basis or to use in times of warfare. So they would keep a list of people they would lock up in case of war or impending war. So they were not messing around. And
No, I
so
might mention in the case of war, Viktor Suvorov pointed out that there were 600 Germans, 600,000 Germans on the communist death list in Germany if the Eastern armies could overrun Germany. And the head of the Carpathian Military District, he had tribunals already set up in the Carpathian Military District for trying German citizens, you know, well, trial is like, you're guilty now, shoot him now. That would be it. And so it was serious business. They had picked out. And of course, I mean, Alex, people like you and me, if we were living in Germany, we'd be on that list.
Exactly.
Because that was all the anti-communists.
And so even under normal circumstances, they would make the choice, the decision for an arrest, and they would grab you during the night or they would grab you off the street. And then they would put you into a holding cell for a couple of weeks. And you were supposed to sit there quietly. You were not allowed to speak, and nobody would give you any significant information. So you would not know what would happen to you, what the charges really are, what the evidence is. You couldn't ask for a lawyer to come to your holding cell or to that facility. And this would drive most people insane because you don't know what's going to happen to your family or what's going to happen to your kids. Are your kids being shipped off to one of these horrendous government facilities, you know, for troubled youth? So if you were unwilling to work, if you were unwilling to function in that socialist system, that was grounds for arrest and punishment. So some people tried to live, you know, a life on, you know, just removed from general society, but that was not legal. So there are some of these rebels even nowadays, you know, who think they can sort of make things work for themselves. But in communist Germany, this was illegal. If you didn't want to work, that was criminal. So after a few weeks of isolation where you go insane, they would start the interrogation process, and they expected you to sign the confession. They expected you to incriminate other people who may also get arrested. And sometimes the punishment was simply a year in prison or 2 years in prison. But this is not where the story ends, because if you're in prison, they might actually recruit you to become a snitch. So they won't let go of you. They really won't let go of you because you've been involved with people that they don't like. And so now you have to spy on these people that you don't like, and you know what's going to happen to them. So this is kind of the reality inside Eastern Germany. And the foreign service, the foreign department of the Stasi, they did everything you could think of. I mean, they had such a broad array of operations, and this model, of course, persists to this very day. These methods are also used in the United States. So I mentioned this former star journalist, Hubert Seipel. Now, he was the first one, coincidentally or not, he was the first one to get a television interview with Edward Snowden. And he got really close to Vladimir Putin, who was KGB, but was working alongside the Stasi in German city of Dresden. And so this journalist was able to go hunting with Putin and ride in his limousine. And they talked, and they made this television piece. This was from 2012, I guess. And this was kind of the most ridiculous propaganda you could think of, paid for by the government, by the German government. And so they put out this TV report, and a few months ago, we learned that Mr. Hubert Seipel, the former star journalist, he took 600,000 euros from Russians for a single book project. So we don't know yet what other sponsoring contracts he might have had, but this is sort of the way this goes. So if you
this
have
is just
that
a
audience,
payoff, isn't it?
If you have that audience, if you have that pull, if you can turn people against America, against the United States, apparently you get paid very, very well. And so to this day, we do not know the full extent of the Stasi infiltration of Western journalism. So we have confirmed about 20 molds, Stasi molds in Western media. This was an NDR journalist and speaker for the Social Democratic Party.
When was this?
This was the Cold War. I don't have a date here, but the NDR, this is the Northern Broadcasting Area, the government broadcasting outfit. So then we have an editor of the Deutschlandfunk, and we have the leader of the West Berlin press conference. So this was kind of an institution. Then they infiltrated journalist school. So this was also something that the Stasi was really good at. They would get their assets into one of these very few universities that churn out the next generation of journalists. So they had one in Cologne, and Cologne is one of the biggest media centers in all of Germany. And the leader of the Cologne journalist school gave to the Stasi 30 names of potential candidates to recruit. So they infiltrated all kinds of spheres of journalism, and the same stuff you expected from the Soviets in the United States. So we're talking the largest newspapers, we're talking the largest television stations. So this was not small stuff. They would go really big. And so then we got this newspaper, a left-wing newspaper. It was called Konkret. That just means concrete. And this Western German newspaper was financed from the East, and they received tens of thousands of Deutschmark per issue. And so one of the journalists that worked there was Ulrike Meinhof, who was tied to this whole terrorist complex, the RAF.
Meinhof gang.
The far-reaching terrorist network, which was tied to a larger Soviet terrorist strategy. And they also, for the most part, they trained communist terrorists, but they also trained Islamist terrorists. And they also did some work with right-wing terrorists. That's what they did.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that they also worked with right wing, because this is what we're seeing more of nowadays, is that the communist services will work with people on the far right.
Exactly. And so they were always going for the big names, the big newspapers, and they did the same thing with Western pop culture. So people nowadays, they realize that pop culture has become really woke, as they say nowadays, the music, and now we see, what was it, Taylor Swift advertising for Joe Biden and the Democrats. And the right wing, they look at this stuff, and depending on what they've looked up on the internet, they may believe that the strategy goes back to the Elders of Zion, or it goes back to what they call the globalists. But this was a large, very large program from the Stasi and the KGB and so on and so forth. So I mentioned this once before. In the 1990s, so this is just after the wall came down, you had the American music labels who were very powerful in Germany. So you had the MTV music station, the television station that would run all these these music videos. And American music was so strong in the 90s, if people remember that. So this made the left very nervous. So the Social Democrats, they had their own agenda. They wanted to have a competing music television station, and they called it Viva. And so that's when all these weirdos got involved to create this new scene of music in Germany, the Unify Germany, and just have it be as woke as possible, multicultural, just as left as possible to get new voters, because they thought in a few years we get a million new voters, or we get 2 million new voters, because these kids, they turn 18.
And yeah, they're aiming at young people. Future voters.
And so the Americans gave us Nirvana, Metallica, Madonna, REM, Dr. Dre, and all this stuff, and some of this music was very, very American, and it was very capitalist. So rappers would flaunt wealth. They would tell their audience that they were involved in serious business. They were having clothing lines. They were selling specific brands. So they were in business. So this is not what the left wanted. They did not want you know, they did not want this kind of an American music in Germany at all. So so they started this initiative, and all these people involved, they had these strange connections. And so, for example, you had Dieter Gauney from the Social Democratic Party, and he's very, very left-wing, and he's tied into the highest levels of the Social Democrats. And so he was chosen to run this music station, turn people against America. And the highest levels of the Social Democrats, they were running this initiative, as far as we can reconstruct that. So there was the Russian honorary consul, as they call it, Heino Wiese. He was involved, apparently. And yeah, he's kind of a dangerous person. Yeah, Steinmeier was in it, and all these people were in it. So they also recruited this young band called Rammstein, which became world famous. And all these Rammstein musicians, these rock musicians, they were basically doing music illegally in communist Germany. So they had sort of a job, but they made music, and they tried to make some money with the music. And the Stasi had completely infiltrated the band and the people surrounding the band. And one of these guys even had a child with a Stasi informant. So at any moment, the Stasi could have decided to arrest these kids and toss them into prison. But they sort of had this idea, maybe we can cultivate the punk rock genre, because at the time, Rammstein or these guys were doing punk rock. Maybe we can use this to network with the Western punk rock scene. And this is apparently what happened. So you got this communist label boss. The label was called Motor Music, and the man was named Tim Renner. So he recruited all these bands, all these left-wing bands. He's very close to Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who is very powerful in Germany and who just wasn't happy with, you know, supporting Ukraine, apparently. Mr. Tim Renner, he used to be a left-wing communist punk as a teenager, and he was networking with the East. So he was also a fan of Stalinist workers' lyric. So this is kind of how all this communist content got into this music. And so this is how it went. And of course, Rammstein became world famous. They played in 2019. They played in Moscow. This was a stadium in Moscow, which holds up to 81,000 people. So the band became very powerful in Russia until they distanced themselves from the Ukraine war. And then, of course, these scandals happened with the band leader and the young women at these concerts. So this may have been a revenge by these old Stasi or these newer Stasi networks, because as long as you play nice with the Russians, you become super famous. First in Germany, in the United States, and Russia, you become super famous. But the moment you you mess with your so-called friends, this is when it gets really dangerous. So this is how
they give you maybe a warning in private, and then if you don't heed the warning, they come down on you.
Yeah, and so there was the keyboarder of the group. He said that he's not mad at these Stasi informants back in the old days, because they let us play music. It's okay, it's fine. But they were ready to arrest them. This is what he really doesn't get. He could have ended up in prison. And we don't exactly know what happened, why they were not arrested, and how they became so famous so quickly, because they became a thing in like 1993, 1994. So a few years after the wall came down, they became one of the biggest bands in Germany, and then, of course, in
Claire Berlinski, the Menace in Europe, she interviews the band, and she tries to imply that they're neo-Nazis, that they reflect a kind of Nazi feeling in Germany. And so what would you say to that? Is that a major misunderstanding on the part of Berlinski?
Well, they took some of their stylistic cues from Eastern bands. There was one band called Laibach, and they played around with these with some fascist symbols, but this was all tongue-in-cheek. And so when the band started, everybody was surprised because it sounded like a right-wing band. These band members later said that the stylistic choice was simply to get attention, because they figured if we did this old punk music we did in the old days, we wouldn't get any big traction. So that this is why they picked it, to gain to get this attention.
So and, it was the shock value.
Exactly. And the singer gave an interview to Kerrang magazine. And he was in Russia at the time when this interview happened. And he admitted that his mother was a member of the Communist Party. So he's probably talking about the SED, the East German Communist Party. And his mother actually continued to work after the wall came down, continued to work for German government media. So from 1992 till 2002, she worked at the NDR as a head of the culture department with this television radio station. So this was government media. Why would they hire her? I mean, we heard a few minutes ago, I mentioned that the NDR was heavily infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have their people everywhere, and they can say, well, we're going to churn out our new assets in journalism. We can churn out our assets in pop culture. And we'll just infiltrate everything. We'll just infiltrate the labels. We'll infiltrate the stations. So this is
well,
how
you know
play.
What? I should mention this. I read the memoirs of German soldiers, and there was a memoir of the German soldier now who was the major who commanded, who was in charge of coordinating the operations in the Battle of Berlin for 9th Army. And of course, that was at the very end of the war. And he was taken prisoner in the Soviet Union. So a good part of his memoir is about being a prisoner. And of course, I don't know what maybe you know the numbers. It had to be more than 1 million German soldiers were taken as prisoners into the former Soviet Union. But he ended up in a special camp. And it's very important for people to understand the context for what happened in Germany. Because you had any soldier that was captured in the war by the Russians that had a connection to somebody of cultural importance or political importance or media importance were put into this special camp where they didn't have to do labor. They were just indoctrinated. They were made to read communist newspapers. They were forced to talk about their thoughts and about their relatives or friends who they knew who were influential in Germany. And the whole idea was, if you don't want to go to forced labor somewhere, work in a mine, maybe be worked to death, you wanted to sign up to be a spy, to work for the communist, the Soviet Union, and to go back and influence that important relative or friend, associate that you had grown up with, whoever it was. And then they would send these guys home. They'd sign a contract. The whole idea was to get them to sign a contract to go home. And of course, this guy ends up going home, but he doesn't talk about what kind of contract he signed, of course. But in order to go home, you had to sign this contract. So they had then thousands and thousands of POWs who had been flipped as spies. They had the communist and far left networks that they'd had even before the war. And then, of course, they had East Germany where they could cultivate and use the Stasi organization to create what was in essence an invasion of West Germany, clear to the point to where when the New York Times in the fall of 1990 had a piece, and this is when some of these Stasi people were flipping and they were capturing files in East Germany, the headline was that there were 100,000 Stasi agents in West Germany in 1990. I mean, that's an invasion. And they didn't just go for anybody. They were focused on getting into the government, the media, the big companies, anything that was influential. That's where they were focused on. And of course, like I said, they would Marcus Wolf, he would go for these attractive German men. Okay, he's good looking, let's use him. And they were to romance secretaries
of important people
jobs. Yeah. And there's famous stories about the ones, about 50 were actually caught, but there had to be hundreds that were not caught. And they
So people have
something lonely women, you know?
So over the last couple of years, people heard about the sleeper agents, right? So this is when the Soviets would recruit people, train them, move them to East Germany, then move them to West Germany, then move them to Canada, and then move them into the United States. So this was supposed to be a multi-generational plan. So you had like a fake couple of two intelligence assets in the United States, and they would have children, and they were expected to recruit their own children into the service. Now, what's another way of playing this? Because if you send like these sleeper agents, or you send some Russian guy who looks Russian, send him to America as a diplomat, it's more difficult for him. But what happens if you have all these German assets and you can send these German assets to America, where they may already have relatives? And so this was, of course, an entryway into the United States by having all these German-speaking guys and very German-looking guys. So this is something that also has not been fully researched yet. You know, just the amount of infiltration that went further, you know, into America. And so the other thing that the Stasi was heavily involved in was terrorism. So imagine the following scenario in America. Some important politician, like on a state level or federal national level, some important politician gets abducted, just grabbed off the street, tossed into a trunk or a van, and then these terrorists would post, spread videos of this man confessing to crimes, confessing to whatever, and these terrorists would make demands or execute the guy, just like Al-Qaeda would do it. So, and this happens again and again and again. Another person gets grabbed, another person gets grabbed, or they just shoot somebody on the street because they have this system where they where they disable the first vehicle and the last vehicle in a convoy. They would jump out of the bushes and then fire upon the vehicle. And usually they would know where the weak points are, you know, when this target person is particularly vulnerable. Now imagine this thing in America today. And so you don't know exactly who these terrorists are, how many there are. And they just, they're just on everybody's mind. And this was a situation especially in the 1970s in Western Germany. So Western German services, they had to come up with new methods of trying to find these people, because they were pretty successful in destabilizing the Western German society. And because of all this additional propaganda, the RAF terror organization, they had a couple of millions of sympathizers in Western Germany. So imagine the situation in America when you have these terrorists, you know, abducting people, and there's millions and millions of people in the United States who glorify this or just voice their support for this program.
And we got that right now with all the people cheering on Hamas.
Yeah, and
in
so
the US.
There was an interesting book in 2012 by Regina Eagle. It was called "Terrorism Lies." And she finally did something that most historians in Germany stayed away from. She looked at all kinds of available Stasi files to piece together how big the support was of the Stasi for these terrorists. And it was utterly massive. So they would get these people, recruit people, send them off on a vacation, and then in the vacation country, they would move them somewhere else, train them in not just terrorism, not just hijacking airliners. This is also something that they would do. They hijack, let's say, an American airliner. Nowadays, they would hijack an American airliner, hold these people hostage in the plane, and demand the release of prisoners, what they call political prisoners, right? And so this was a massive, massive undertaking, and nobody could really know where they would strike where they would strike next.
Well, you know, these Germans were involved in training the terrorists or the Islamists who assaulted or took the Grand Mosque in 1979. People forget that in 1979, there wasn't just a revolution in Iran that overthrew the Shah, but there was also an attempted revolution in Saudi Arabia. And the Arab terrorists that were involved in that event at the Grand Mosque in Saudi Arabia were trained in Libya by Cuban and East German trainers. So,
yeah, this is how they played it. And they also they funneled weapons to groups like Palestinian groups. They would funnel weapons to these people, and they would have these deals of using these terrorist training camps. And something that people need to be aware of is that it's not just baseline terrorism. This is a program to completely destabilize a country and then take it over. So some of the most important people at the Stasi leadership, they had training in the Spanish Civil War. And so they were running some serious operations. They were trained in taking a country over and then ran the security service. So this is not just a, you know, pinprick strategy. They can scale this up fairly well. Now imagine if these people recruit Islamists in America or right-wing terrorists in America, and they start bombing things, or they start using smallpox or something, or they start using environmental eco-terrorists and give them smallpox, something like that. This is very easily done. So when the wall came down, the central station in Karlshorst, this was East Berlin, this was the KGB center. And so this is when they started to burn Stasi files, many, many Stasi files. They actually used a flamethrower because they didn't have enough oven capacity to do that with these burn bags or what they call them. So they used a flamethrower, and somebody started to ask, shouldn't we move these Stasi files to Moscow, or shouldn't we move these files instead of burning it? But the answer was, don't worry, we have everything in copy. You know, over the years, all this stuff was copied.
Went to Moscow.
We're just burning the stuff we don't need.
Imagine what Moscow knows. And what's really interesting is that, you know, I was told by different sources that not only with East Germany, but with Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Romania, more than a year before the Berlin Wall came down, they were moving files out of those countries to Moscow, the important ones. So Moscow knew what was coming. They knew what they were planning to do. And so they were summoning those files out, which I thought was really very telling that was going on more than a year before. And you could find that in different source books. But
yeah, and they also, and they knew the minds of Germans very, very intimately. So even when they lost a certain amount of assets, because some of these databases were sold by Soviets to the Americans. So this was sold to a CIA guy called James Atwood, for example. This was the asset file of the Stasi, the foreign service, the HBA. And so the Soviets lost a bunch of assets because their identities were blown, but they could obviously rebuild these networks because they knew how to do it, and they knew how these Germans really worked and what their mind was, and so
but
they could.
What about the idea of now, I've heard this from different sources, but I've never been able to validate it from the point of view of actually proving it, but that there were pedophile networks were being set up in Eastern Europe and in Germany to try to recruit Westerners on the basis of sexual perversion. Have you heard anything like that?
There was a scandal. We call it the Saxony Swamp scandal. That's the direct translation. And Yeah, we know some. There's some confirmed stuff when Vladimir Putin was running assets at the time. You know, he worked for the KGB, but he was working alongside the Stasi in Dresden. And so there was some confirmed Western assets, even neo-Nazi assets, were pedophiles. And some observers have noted that the German, nowadays, the German extreme right wing, the German extreme right wing has a massive problem with pedophilia. So we pieced together quite a few of these little bits, but of course we do not have the full picture. Now we know that this came out I think 10 years ago or something. We know that when the wall came down, there was a massive new production of underage pornography in these former communist states. This is when these new movies were being sold internationally, and these movies were shot in former Soviet countries. And so you had better cameras, better lighting, better editing. This was a new generation of underage pornography. And
and about what year did this start appearing?
This was in the 90s, and then we had this, and this is tied to a pretty infamous case. Some of these filmmakers from former Eastern Bloc, they sold their material, sold their films to a Canadian or an American company, and this was sort of a softcore, material, and they were selling this in Canada, in the United States, because at the time they believed it was covered under the First Amendment because it was softcore. They also sold this from Canada and the United States. They sold this back to Europe. And this is when a very high-ranking social democrat in Germany got caught with it, basically. So he was an up-and-coming politician. He could have become chancellor. He could have become anything. And his name was Edati, Mr. Edati, and so he bought this stuff from overseas, as far as I can remember, with his own credit card, because he was being stupid, because he thought this was legal material, so nobody's going to come after him. And then the United States Supreme Court made a decision, declared this material to be illegal. The company got raided, and so the investigators got hold of the customer file. And so this started this big international investigation, and one of the people that got into trouble was this powerful German politician, the social democrat. And so the wheels started turning, and when his home was raided and his offices were raided, the investigators found that some devices are apparently missing. So they saw like the outline of a computer, but it's just the outline and dust. So the computer was gone. He claimed his government issued laptop was lost or stolen. And some of these investigators, they traced back his online his online history, and there was a suspicion that he was accessing other stuff. But he got off easy. And he was never heard from again, but he may have become very, very powerful in German politics. And there was one guy, I think he was an American, but I don't remember his name. I can pull it up. There was an American who was also a customer of these movies. He was raided, and he tried to toss one of his hard drives out of his window to make it disappear, but he was caught, and I think he committed suicide. I just have to pull that up. But this is sort of, this was the new generation of underage pornography, and this was all produced or hosted on servers, or produced and hosted on former Soviet territory. So this was...
That is very interesting. Now, you may know, remember in June of 2006, there was this famous video that kind of went viral, and you can see it on YouTube today. They still have it. It's Putin is walking, I think it's in Moscow or St. Yeah. Petersburg. He's walking through a crowd, and there's this little boy. He's maybe 4 years old, and Putin walks up to the boy, pulls up the boy's shirt, and kisses him on the belly, and then stands up, pats him on the head, and moves on. And was asked about it later and said, well, the boy was irresistible.
And, really?
Yeah. And this triggered an essay, an actual article
by Litvinenko.
The FSB defector, yeah, Alexander Litvinenko. And this was a very curious thing because some of them, at least one of the former KGB guys that I know, thought that this is the reason that Litvinenko was killed, was assassinated with polonium famously later in 2006. And he was given a fatal dose. I think it was November 1st. He was right after the assassination of Anna Politkovskaya. Litvinenko, they put it in his tea in a London hotel, right? But anyway, Litvinenko, now you can't find this article online anywhere about Putin that Litvinenko wrote. I can't find it. Maybe you can. But I did read it at the time. And what Litvinenko claimed that this colonel, who was his mentor in the KGB FSB, when Putin was, I think in 96, he became head of the FSB. And this guy's comment to Litvinenko was, well, now the homosexuals and the perverts are taking over the FSB. And this, of course, this colonel was gunned down. I think he was shot dead on his porch like 2 years later after that. But he had basically told Litvinenko that Putin was originally going to be in the first chief directorate. He's going to be a KGB foreign spy, what they called then the PGU. He was going to be working in West Germany. But they discovered this, that he had these, he was bisexual and he had these other proclivities, right? According to Litvinenko. Now, this is what
I remember Litvinenko, this article.
Right. And of course, the idea was that then Putin was trained to work in East Germany and sent there to work on this perversion. One of the things he did was to work on these networks involving perversion. So it's interesting that if there is was a connection to a pedophilia scandal in Germany connected back to Dresden, where Putin worked out of, is there such a connection?
Well, I mean, for decades, left-wing circles supported by the Stasi and also by the KGB, left-wing circles had promoted this idea in Western Germany of decriminalizing sex with minors. So this was a large push, and they had a pseudoscientific argument for it. They would compare two extremes. They would say, well, back in the old days, you know, sexuality was so restrictive in the West, and this brought forth the authoritarian personality, which the communists tried to get rid of. And so they promoted the other extreme, early sexual experimentation, adults with children, all this sort of stuff. And of course, the left was very, very much into sexual research and the, you know, children's education. So this is something the communists had thoroughly infiltrated. And I remember that somebody gave me an old, well, it's sort of a flyer. It's sort of an information brochure, I think you could call it. And this was circulated in Western Germany for many, many years. So I have it somewhere. I have it somewhere in my stacks of material. And so there were hundreds of thousands of copies made of this brochure. And when it was removed from circulation, the existing copies were not destroyed. They're still around. And so somebody gave me a pristine copy of this brochure. And so I read it and I did a report on it. And it basically encouraged parents to play with their little children in a sexualized context, and to also stimulate sexual relations of children among each other. So just to normalize it as much as possible. And so
what is the age of consent in Germany today?
Well, if baseline is 14, before the age
really?
Of four, before the age of 14, you have no say in this whatsoever. And then if somebody is, let's say, 14 and the partner is older than 18, this requires the consent of the parents of the younger child. But there was a significant push in various political parties and activist circles to decriminalize sexual relations almost completely. And so this was a gigantic push. And for a long time, people thought little of it. But over the last couple of years, people started to remember all that stuff that went on for so long. So you create sort of this...
Do you think that the push to lower the age of consent and to legalize pedophilia, do you think that that was coming from people who were under blackmail threat from the Stasi or the Russians?
Well, there's strong indications for that, because if there was some studies being done, this became a scandal like a few years ago when it was rediscovered, you know, some files were rediscovered. So some of these scientists, they were studying child sexuality, they would put children, foster children, orphans, they would put them into the care of known pedophiles. And then they would just observe and study this situation and try to figure out what would be the consequences of it. So
actually put real children in mm-hmm. the care, quote unquote, yeah. of pedophiles.
Yeah, I can pull that up and be
that
specific.
That is so monstrous. That is so incredibly monstrous.
Yeah, and so when people are confronted with all this propaganda saying, you know, this is all okay, this is the way to go, this is how we create, this is sort of how we create the socialist person of the future, right? Because they argued early sexuality would lead to a free spirit or a loving, kind spirit and not the authoritarian personality type, which they hated. And so this was a fairly large program at the time. Many years ago when I was a kid, my parents would subscribe to these mainline political magazines, right? And they would get sort of a conservative magazine, they would get a left-wing magazine for whatever reason. And so we had stacks of these issues lying around. And then at some point, this left-wing magazine, the mainstream magazine, they had sort of as a title story, nude photography of children. So they chose to have a leading story in this publication that was just about nude photography of children.
What age children?
Like 5 to 13.
What?
Maybe? Yeah, I mean, of course, this may come as a surprise to Americans, but in Germany, you would have, let's say, commercials with naked women for a long time, and so they tried to push these boundaries. Okay, so they were pushing these boundaries, so people thought, you know, it's completely normal to see naked people in daytime television. But then, of course, they started to introduce this idea of, you know, let's just embrace the beauty of naked children in a mainstream magazine. Okay, so this was a larger program, and every center of this initiative was working like a magnet. So people would flock to these centers of activism, people who were likely pedophile, and they would start to get involved. And
what do you suppose? Is there any study showing that this increases pedophilia, that this increases crimes against children, or do they not even enforce sexual crimes against children in Germany?
Well, there was it never got off the ground to decriminalize sex among children, sex with children, you know, adults with children. But at the same time, you saw this underground. This underground all over Europe. So, for example, in Portugal, there was a big scandal a couple of years ago in Portugal. And Portugal is a very left-wing country. For many years, a super left-wing party ran this country. And I think up until the 90s, right into the 1990s, I think that having sex with a child was not even considered an actual real crime. It was more like a misdemeanor type thing. And so this is when, you know, things started to gravitate towards Portugal. And some very famous people, television personalities, politicians, they got caught in a scandal involving an orphanage, a children's orphanage that was used to get the children for these influential customers. Then you had the underground pornography in Holland, you know, the Netherlands, Belgium. This was always a gigantic problem. So if you were a German, you could just cross the border into, you know, the Netherlands and you know, try to buy material that was illegal in Germany. Or you could go to Portugal, for that matter. So yeah, it's difficult to piece together, but you can always tell there's a very large scale left-wing influence in this. And as I've mentioned, in the 1990s, this is when investigators started to notice a new wave of underage pornography, you know, with better cameras, better lighting, professional production, and editing and distribution. So this was a larger program, apparently.
So there was a attempt by the communists to use pedophilia. And has anybody in the Stasi stepped forward to talk about this at all? Any former Stasi people?
Here and there. I mean, if you go through the literature, you find some details about some operations. But I don't think that anybody who worked at the Stasi really had was a regular foreign asset or something, or an analyst. I don't think anybody in the regular levels of the Stasi had an idea of how big this program was. And to this day, we do not know how big this this program really was. Because it was done for a long time. It was done with videotapes. It was done with magazines, gloss, high gloss magazines and all that sort of stuff. And then came the internet. You know, this was in the late 90s. This is when the internet happened. And so people, a lot of people were not careful in the early internet, and they were just accessing all kinds of stuff. And there was a lot of hosting of that kind of material on servers in former Soviet countries. So they would get these, they would know who accessed this material. And then came the forums. This is kind of the current generation of distribution. So people would access these encrypted forums and share material. And this is also where...
So this is a big intelligence gathering operation, basically. And if there are elements in the intelligence services in the former East Bloc countries, they could be running this with the Russians. They could be gathering intelligence on Americans. They could be getting blackmail on businessmen, teachers, media figures, anybody who actually goes for this sort of thing, right?
Exactly. So
what an easy way to get blackmail on people, by the way.
Exactly, because if you were caught, let's say in the 1970s, if you were a regular guy or you were caught with some magazine or whatever, this was not a big deal. But in the current era, you know, this is a much, much bigger deal, because we saw this with this social democrat politician, Edati, in Germany. He was so powerful, and then his life was over. I mean, in public, I mean, his life was basically over, and he's probably disappeared to a place like Morocco or something. But it's unclear if the Russians or anybody had tried to contact him and tried to, you know, maybe gain access to more information, because he was not happy. He was not happy with the outcome. He actually tried to defend himself in the media, and he said that he was just interested in the art of naked boys. He was apparently into boys. He was just interested in the art side of it, and the material he accessed was softcore, you know, these movies he bought from Canada or America. So he actually tried to push through and continue his life, but that wasn't possible at that time. So his party, his party dropped him. But you know, if he's bitter now, you know, the Russians may start to talk to him.
Well, I should remind the listeners of Dennis Hastert, who was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, a Republican from Illinois, who was indicted on federal charges of not only, you know, evading bank reporting requirements, but he was sentenced on, he pleaded guilty to sexual misconduct and paying hush money to people. And apparently it was sexual abuse of teenage boys. He was sentenced to, I think, 15 months in prison for the financial offenses related to the sexual abuse of teenage boys. And that was the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the U.S.
Yeah.
Is shocking, right? I mean...
Yeah, I just pulled up the old report I did at the time. So the company was called Azov Films, you know, like the Azov Battalion. It was called Azov Films, and this was kind of an online store that was selling DVDs of naked children from the former Soviet Eastern Bloc, naked children just playing. And so they were constantly making new movies, selling them all over the world. And so they were sold from Canada, but they were shot in, these movies were produced in Crimea, Russia, and Romania. So the Azov chief was called Brian Way, and they called this the Amazon of nude videos of kids. And so at the time, people noticed some signs that there was hardcore material also being produced by the same people, produced in Eastern Europe. And this special stuff was sold to rich VIP customers. So there was a man called Igor R. They don't give you the full name. And Igor was targeted by investigations. He studied, of course, he studied, he was in the Soviet military. So he was more high ranking in the Soviet military, probably a spy. And there were some Ukrainian politicians who were involved in this at the, what we call the Black Sea. So they were, so if you were a fan of the movies, apparently you could get into contact with the people who produced the movies, and then you can make some sort of an arrangement if you had enough money. So this was that background, and then. A man called Ryan Loskarn, who was chief of staff of U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander, committed suicide because investigators found hardcore material on his computer. And the investigators found him because of these softcore Azov films. So apparently he wanted to get everything. He wanted to get the hardcore stuff. He wanted to get the Azov stuff. But they caught him because of the Azov movies. And so investigators, they rammed down his door in Washington, D.C. And according to investigators, Loskarn tried to hide a hard disk drive on his roof. But they found that. And Bruce Downsborough, former CEO of the University of Tennessee Foundation, pled guilty in 2013 to have bought Azov Films. And there was a George Downsborough Sr. He was involved with HRB Singer Raytheon, which sold technology to the NSA. So imagine the potential for espionage with all of this. So you get this one guy, and then you get another guy, and this guy can, you know, maybe bug some technology that goes straight to the NSA. It's just, this is just something that they perfected in Germany, and then they exported this to the United States. This was the background of that.
Yeah, and then we have Anthony Weiner, the famous case. He'd been a congressman, I think, for about 10 years. Democrat representing the 9th District in New York, and he was caught passing, I think it was illicit material, pictures of himself to a minor over the internet, and he got 21 months in prison. And of course, he was married to Hillary Clinton's chief of staff, I think. And we're trying to remember her name, but this is all over the map in politics. And these are just the people we know about, right?
Yeah.
This is, and of course, you have the case of Scott Ritter, who was convicted of...
didn't he just pop up in North Korea or something? Or Russia or someplace?
Well, he was in Chechnya. He was saying
Chechnya.
How he was in, and he was saying, go Hamas, I think.
Yeah.
But Ritter had been an arms control inspector, and he'd become a political voice in favor of Russia now. And of course, he had a conviction. He had attempted to, I think he exposed himself or something like that to a law enforcement officer that was posing as a 14-year-old online.
Yeah.
So, and apparently there'd been earlier incidences and they kind of let him go without really prosecuting him. So in this case, they prosecuted him.
And also, there's another aspect of Stasi operations, which was to infiltrate NATO and infiltrate American circles on German soil. Now, of course, there are there's a NATO headquarters here in Germany. There are military, large military bases here in Germany. There's so many American facilities in Germany. Now, obviously, that was something that the Stasi would attack quite a bit. And there's one incident here. So the year was 1968. The West German Admiral Hermann Lütke committed suicide. He was tasked with logistics at the NATO headquarters in Europe. And he knew the exact location of roughly 1,000 nuclear weapons. So he was caught... photographing documents with a small Minox camera, which is kind of the standard kit for spies. And he was found dead in a forest, so maybe he was murdered. On the same day, his friend, shot himself, and he was the vice chief of the Foreign German Intelligence Service, the BND, Generalmajor Horst Wendland. So they claim that this suicide, when he shot himself, on the same day the other guy died, the friend died, they claimed the suicide was just because he was depressed. But this was not the end of this, because here, for example, the KGB defector Oleg Gordievsky commented on the case because Gordievsky said that Gordievsky knew another defector from the Czechoslovakian intelligence, or this was a defector from the Czechoslovakian intelligence, and according to that guy, Mr. Wendland was spying for the STB. So this one guy gets shot somehow in the forest, and in the same day, this guy blows his head off, or just shoots himself in the head.
STB is, of course, the Czech Stasi, yeah. The Czech KGB.
And so this was not even the end of it. This is when... In October of 1968, this was the same month, so you have two powerful people dead, both suspected spies. In the same month, there were four additional deaths in ministries, West German ministries, and there were also seven high-ranking scientists escaping to the GDR, you know, the Soviet East Germany. So this was kind of a ring that got busted. And some people got warned early, and so they managed to escape, and they were never seen again in the West. That's kind of how they play it. So people in America, they have to be aware that this sort of espionage can reach the highest levels. I mean, we're talking vice director of this, vice chief of that, you know, just responsible for 1,000 nuclear weapons, you know, this and the other. And so they tried to get these young men. The Stasi would try to recruit young men, send them to university, and help them gain entry into NATO, especially NATO headquarters in Brussels, to steal documents. So, for example, you had this man called Rainer Rupp, codename Topaz. He started to work at the NATO headquarters in Brussels, and he stole, among many other things, a paper called MC-161, classified as Cosmic Top Secret. This is kind of what the NATO knew about. This is what NATO knew about what the Soviets knew about Western defenses. So this became, of course, a huge problem. So how do you defend Germany, Western Germany and Western Europe, if the Soviets know what you know? So this is just how they played it. They could infiltrate American circles.
Every one of these Warsaw Pact countries, which is Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, every one of these countries, they were tightly linked in with the KGB and their operations, and each had their assigned area. For example, Romania was assigned to specialize in Egypt at one point and to be involved there. You had, and what's interesting is that the Stasi actually, and this is why communism is an international movement, it's not just Russians. Stasi was, when the Sandinistas took power in Nicaragua, the Stasi sent four people immediately over there. And they actually trained bodyguards for the first anniversary celebration of the Sandinistas taking power back, that was around 1979 or 80. So they were Stasi bodyguards, Stasi, protection service, so to speak. So they were, it was all in the family. And of course, the Bulgarians were there also in helping the Nicaraguans and the Cubans. And of course, it was an all in the family kind of thing. All of these, it was their international duty, so to speak. And in fact, the Stasi was involved in South Africa, helping the terrorist armed wing of the African National Congress back in the 1980s. So they were not just spying on America, not just, flooding West Germany with agents, but they were contributing to the communist movement and terrorist organizations worldwide.
Eventually, the Stasi even got very close to German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. If people remember, this was this kind of this obese guy, very tall, obese guy. He was known to be an anti-communist, but the Stasi found out about his special money funds to further his career, and so Helmut Kohl.
He had a political slush fund, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Helmut Kohl was working with people he trusted. This was Eberhard von Brauchitsch and Friedrich Flick. This was the younger Flick of the old Nazi corporation. Mm-hmm. And the American High Commissar, John J. McCloy, once pardoned the old Flick. So they kind of thought this was a workable setup, but there was just one problem because one of these guys involved in this funny money business, one guy involved was named Hans Adolf Kanter. So he worked for the Stasi, he worked for the MFS, and they got all this material and they decided to cut a deal. So this would have been a public mega scandal, but they just sort of had this deal. They would leave Helmut Kohl alone with this in public, but Soviet East Germany would get new bank loans and they would get some other concessions. So this is also how they play it.
I was going to ask you this, in Ralph Hope's book, The Grey Men, he talks about the Stasi clubs or groups that still exist that are working with the communists in Germany, with the far left in Germany to this day, and how they appear to be well-financed, and they appear to be very optimistic about their future prospects. And so you're talking about Kohl. I mean, many of them, obviously, from his account, appear to be still cooperating with the Russians, cooperating with the communist movement generally. To what extent do some of these Stasi networks continue on and were responsible for scandalizing Kohl, getting rid of him, and bringing in someone like Angela Merkel to be the leader? I mean, such an unlikely person, a former East German communist youth leader, to become the head of the Christian Democratic Union. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, she was always under the radar for a very long time. They called her Helmut Kohl's little girl because she had this this very subdued personality in public, and nobody paid any attention to her, even though she didn't have any political experience whatsoever. She was a physicist, okay? She was a physicist, quite an advanced one.
Well, she did have experience in politics in East Germany, being this youth leader, which she kind of hid, right?
Well, you had to be a member of these organizations, and she, of course, painted this as, you know, something that was not worthy of note. There was suspicion that she was a sort of a half scientist, half spy. This is one of the suspicions that came up because she knew from her advanced studies what kind of technology needed to be stolen from the West. So if you have just a regular trained foreign spy, he can make contact with, you know, target person, scientists, but this agent would not understand the science at all. So you needed sort of a handler that was somewhat trained in espionage, but was also a scientist himself or herself. So this was something
that... So they would know what was important to steal and not to steal stuff that didn't matter.
Exactly. So she could potentially say, well, we are behind in this field, or we have indications that Western institutes are working on this, that, or the other, so maybe we can steal that. So
how did she get to be so close to Kohl? I mean, how did that happen?
She was under the radar, but some important people in the Christian Democratic Party, some important people, they supported her. And then she snuck away to the top, and nobody could really understand this. And she was always kind of a sphinx. She would never talk about her private life. All of her family members were super quiet. Nobody would ever say anything. And she's probably the weirdest chancellor that we ever had. And
longest serving one you ever had.
Yeah, exactly. And so this was the era when the Christian Democrats, a conservative party, became sort of a party of the middle. More migrants, you know, more this, more that. And somehow she managed to change the party from within. And she was able to push out some of these other people and become so influential for so long. Even though she was not formally trained in diplomacy or just running anything, you know, that's not science. I mean, this was just an incredible oddity when that happened. But you know, this was going on everywhere. I mean, even the Green Party was for a long time very much infiltrated by the Stasi. For example, you had Mr. Dirk Schneider. He was at some point even speaker of the Greens in the parliament, and so he always tried to push the party to move closer to the GDR and the SED party over there. And he was involved in some radical left circles, circles that would publish bomb making manuals. So they would have these Antifa publications that would teach people how to make bombs. And so there were some arrests made at the time. In 1995, all over the country, there were police swooped in and they arrested 50 people because of one of these publications. And the investigators were also looking for the anti-imperialist cell, the committee, as it was called. And they were looking for one person who was supposedly a member of the Red Army faction, which was the main terrorist, leftist terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. Police found 120 kilograms of explosives, documents, passports, and so on and so forth. And this guy, Rainer Trampert, he went to Moscow and he talked to the Soviet president Andrei Gromyko and other Kremlin people. And this guy is still around, even. He's still around. 2 weeks.
You know what amazes me is when I was reading about the Romeos that Marcus Wolf sent over to recruit the secretaries, was that the 50 or so that were caught, the secretaries that were caught, most of them, they got very light sentences. It's not like major spies in America. They lock them up for years. They would give them 2-3 year sentences, but some of them would even get off. It's like the judge would feel sorry for them for being victimized by the Romeo spies. Is it generally that this kind of espionage treason in Germany was not punished severely, or was there circumstances?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I compare, punishments that were handed out, if I compare this to Britain or the United States, I mean, this is a completely different world. I mean, sometimes people would get 8 years in prison or 10 years, but not even serve that much time, or they get swapped because there were so many assets locked up in the East, so they would always just swap them. Now, of course, you have to imagine what's the deterrence here? I mean, if espionage is punished so lightly, I mean, how do you keep people from doing this stuff, right?
Especially when it pays so well.
Yeah, when it pays well. I mean, we just saw that. 600,000 euros for one major book publication. And that is on top of what this person, this Seipel guy, made from the book itself, from the book sales. And so maybe you get a couple of tens of thousands, you know, for the book, and then you get 600,000 on top of it from the Russians. And of course, these spies and traitors, they would always hope they would get an early warning. You know, if Western authorities would inch closer to them and probably expose them. So sometimes these people actually escaped. They would go to the East and get all these rewards and the medals. And some of these people even became Stasi instructors. They were regarded as heroes. They would give these presentations in front of the new generation of Stasi agents, Stasi assets. So less than 2 weeks before the Chernobyl nuclear incident, four leading members of the Green Party, the German Green Party, went to Moscow. And so they were hosted like stars, and they were treated very, very well. So normally it was expected that these green politicians would have their press conference in the German embassy, but instead they picked the hotel of the Soviet Central Committee. So this is how they played it back then. These were the Greens who became pretty influential in the 1990s. You know, this was alongside the Social Democrats.
They were watermelon greens, green on the outside and red on the inside.
Exactly. And so nowadays, some of these green activists nowadays who engage in low grade terrorism. They want to destroy things. They just damage power lines. They damage all kinds of stuff. And you see a clear, distinct anti-Western strain. It's anti-capitalist. So they view themselves as old school communists, even though the current generation, they never actually experienced the Cold War themselves, and they probably don't even know that much about what they're working for. This is the current generation. So they say we either become radical or we become insignificant. You know, irrelevancy or militancy. These are the two choices. And and this goes back to some other groups like the Animal Liberation Front and the so many.
Did
of
they
these
come out of Germany too?
No, but there's sort of an international organizations or similar organizations, and they not just free animals, they will also burn down a ski resort, they will burn down facilities and cause...
They'll attack labs where animals are used in medical experiments, I know that.
Yeah, and so they would also terrorize scientists, they would terrorize people. And it's part of, I mean, they try to cover everything. They try to cover everything. So, for example, we now know that the Soviets tried to make it look as if Americans had invented AIDS or HIV. So this was this East Berlin biology professor, Jakob Segal. And so, this was like the late 80s when they would publish these texts. One of the articles was called AIDS Man-Made in USA. And so now we know a lot more about that operation. They had this operation called Denver. This was the Stasi and the KGB, and they wanted to make it look like America invented AIDS. They started in a pro-Soviet newspaper in India, and this whole paper was a KGB creation run by Ilya Cherkvilov, and so this entire newspaper was just made to spread disinformation. And so they had a fake anonymous letter that said AIDS was created in Fort Detrick. So this is how they spread the story, because the original article was reprinted in Kuwait, Bahrain, Finland, Sweden, Peru, and eventually it reached Western Germany and even the United States. So they will latch onto anything, any topic whatsoever, just make people angry, just get people very, very angry. Very angry about this stuff, and they would always use some real little bits of information. So, for example, Fort Detrick was real. Yes, United States was researching biological agents. But they would use these little bits and then add some fake stuff to it, and then publish a story somewhere, and then it would spread all around the world. And at some point, people thought, well, so many newspapers have covered this, so there must be something to it, right?
Right.
And
yeah, it's the way they're trying to depict the outbreak of COVID-19 in China, making it sound like it's some kind of an American intelligence op, you know. And of course, China's propaganda trying to say that America had basically spread it, you know, and this is a story. They don't push it that hard, but it's out there. You can find it. And you had a committee there in Berlin headed by the guy that sued Volkswagen. I'm not remembering his name. He was licensed to practice law in California and in Germany. And there was an anti-NATO I watched all of the presentations, and he finally said things that showed me that he was definitely anti-NATO and that he had some kind of background on the far left in Germany, probably going back to the Cold War.
This was the time when even Russia Today, the television station and website, when they were pushing all kinds of nonsense. And at the same time, for the domestic audience in Russia, RT would say the exact opposite. So they would tell Russians one thing and say, yeah, it's just, we're dealing with a pandemic, we do what we can, just don't complain, and activism is now illegal. But they would say something completely different for the Western audience. And they would say
Rainer Fulmick, I think, is the guy's name.
Yeah, there were many of these characters that nobody really heard from before, and suddenly they became famous and created all this media attention for themselves and their cause. This was all about, you know, just that as if the pandemic was fake. You don't need to do anything. And at the same time, you could monitor how the Russians were dealing with the pandemic, and they were using every standard baseline tool which they had available to them. And of course, the medical system in Russia got into huge trouble. We saw some of the footage on social media of these endless convoys of emergency vehicles waiting to gain access to a Russian hospital. So this was not a fun time to be a Russian, especially the older people, the alcoholics, and so on and so forth. This was not fun. But every time Russia would ease on the domestic policies regarding the pandemic, these propagandists in the West would say, see, Russia is not really, you know, responding to the pandemic because they know it's fake. And this kept going on back and forth. You know, then they would increase, you know, the pandemic response, then they would step off the gas. And yeah, that was that's something that I noticed, you know, with the Operation Denver thing, with the AIDS, the AIDS disinformation. So you saw kind of a clear parallel. I mean, you could expect that in the future when there's, for example, when there's a smallpox pandemic. Expect these Russian propagandists to say that, you know, America did this and this and that, and don't get vaccinated against smallpox, or don't protect yourself against smallpox or something. I mean, there's no end to this. There's literally no end to this.
I have to go since our time is up, and I want to thank you, Alex, for educating us on the Stasi. And I want to thank the listeners for being with us. I'm Jeff Nyquist. This has been Alex Benesch. I'm in America. He's in Germany. We were talking about the effectiveness of the Stasi. And let me tell you, they were very effective, and like the Russians. And we just, the West German service, CIA, the FBI, they could not deal with these people. I forgot to mention one thing, that during the Cold War, the United States, they tried to recruit, I don't know, 20, 30 spies in East Germany. They had about that many. And it turned out that every one of those spies were double agents. They were just feeding fake information to the CIA. So that is how I'll close things. And thank you very much for joining us.